you're sort of finishing up with your residencies.
Yeah.
And in internal medicine in North Philadelphia in a working section. Go on, please. Yeah.
Well, I saw what my associate or the boss was doing, and it was a lot of injection stuff that really I didn't think was particularly great medicine. And yet it was a cash flow sort of thing. And it was sort of the bulk of the practice. And I really didn't think much. But also at times when I knew that these people needed some medical tests, and I needed more tests, that I wasn't too sure they could afford it or they had the money to pay for it. And I get a little bit disturbed by this, of course. I would have to temper any practice of what I thought was decent medicine with these economic considerations. And I started wondering, is there a better way of doing this somehow? And I happened to see a very, very small advertisement in the Pennsylvania State Medical Journal for a residency at the Kettering Laboratory of the University of Cincinnati in occupational medicine. And the residency paid $4,100 a year. And my contract with this other doctor was paying about $3,900 a year for working like a dog. And I said, this is ridiculous. Furthermore, I thought this thing through. I said, well, you know, if I work in a corporation and work in occupational medicine, I will not have these major cost constraints on practice. In other words, if tests were needed, then I would be able to get the tests and not have to worry too much about whether people could afford it or not. And the things were needed, and I think I could make cases for them and wouldn't have these economic constraints, which is a little bit naive, but not totally so. And with this sort of rationale, I figured, well, this internal medicine is really turning out to be general practice because in Philadelphia, you know, we've got all these great specialists, so as an internist, I think I ought to be able to handle diabetes or coronaries, but then if there was someone had diabetes, they went to see the super specialist down at the medical school. In cardiology, the same thing. So I could see it ending back up in general practice. I wasn't terribly interested in that. So these sort of elements went into the decision making as to why I went into the specialty. I thought I could be freed up of some of these economic constraints on practicing decent medicine, which indeed is generally worked out to be the case. So we did the unheard of thing in Philadelphia. If you went to medical school, you open an office on the corner and you practice there and you're the doctor and that's nice. Maybe if you're a little less than long enough, you're a big doctor. Even if you were 5'6". And I did what people didn't do. I said, we're going to leave Philadelphia. That was unheard of. Everybody thought it was some kind of a kook. To leave this sure thing, you know, open your office on the corner, and you had a good living and all this jazz, and I thought of something more to it. And furthermore, I could see what was happening. I could see that you wore a path from the office in the morning to the hospital, and then the hospital had house calls, and the house calls back to the office at night, and you wore a triangular path that was over and over and over like an animal in a cage, and the path got deeper and deeper, and you finally lost view of the horizon. And you only saw what you were doing, and that was the whole life. And I said, hey, this is nonsense. This doesn't make sense. But, you know, in a sense, this is what medicine demands, that you be totally, totally, totally engaged. And I thought, hey, there has to be a better way of living than this. Well, of course, this was also before the time of what I think are sort of monstrosity sort of incomes that physicians have come to be expected to generate. And it wasn't that sort of money at all, really. But the money was really not the major consideration, except as impacted upon the ability to practice decent medicine for people. So with this in mind, I did the unheard of thing. We left Philadelphia and went to Cincinnati.
How'd you get the job?
Well, I applied for it, wrote a letter, and the program director was going around the country, interviewed me at dinner downtown mm-hmm. Philadelphia, Benjamin Franklin Hotel, and he asked me why I wanted to go into this, what I thought it was about. And of course, that time, of course, nuclear energy was starting to be a big issue, and big thing anyway. And I sort of focused on that, and he said, well, you know, it's nothing more than occupational medicine, really. And we had discussion, and I was accepted for the program, and I was then accepted as a fellow at this, for fellowship in this program at the University of Cincinnati, the Kettering Laboratory.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it turned out that I'd made a pretty good pick.
Mm-hmm.
That this was one of the foremost training programs in the country. There was one here in Pittsburgh at the time. There was one at Harvard, and I'm not too sure there was one at Hopkins. No, there wasn't one at Hopkins. But it was a good choice, a very solid choice. And so that's another 2 year of postdoctoral work, and that's led to the degree of Doctor of Science
mm-hmm.
in Occupational Environmental Medicine, or Occupational Medicine, as it's called then. So it's 50. Doctor Science, it's DSD period, capital S, small c, creates. It's a degree which has some currency around the country. Occupational medicine, yeah. No, it wasn't called that then. Environmental wasn't around yet. But that required a doctoral thesis.
Mm-hmm. What'd you write it on?
Well, I wrote on something which was very interesting to me. It was on ballistocardiography, something which has died, but which had a very interesting thesis, and that is that you will notice as you're lying in bed that every time your heart beats, if you're very aware of this, you'll find the bed moves on the springs. Well, someone had come up with the idea, well, if we can measure the forces, the ejection forces, which kicks the heart
mm-hmm.
as a reactive force, which goes toward the foot, and then the other restorative forces, which go...
Restorative.
Yeah, mm-hmm. all right. And someone had the idea, a professor in Philadelphia, actually, that you could possibly measure cardiac output that way.
Mm-hmm.
A very neat principle. There's only one problem with it. Unfortunately, between the heart and the table, there are a lot of coupling forces,
mm-hmm.
which
damping and coupling.
Damping and coupling, and they couldn't at that time really bust them out,
yeah.
analyze them.
Mm-hmm.
And no one ever succeeded in doing it. Well, anyway, it was an active area of research, and I thought I would do it on this subject, and it was very interesting, anyway. But that was the first research project, more or less.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a 2 year program, and then the third year of the program was spent in industry. And so we moved from Cincinnati in 56 and were in Wilmington, Delaware with DuPont from 1956 to 57. And that was a very good experience. I rotated through a number of plants, different chemical processes.
Mm-hmm. What were you doing?
I was trying to learn what they were doing there. I was observing, I was participating. For example, spent a fair amount of time at one plant, which is a very large organic synthesis plant, and I would, for example, they had a new process set up, okay, I would go through the chemistry of the process, the toxicology of the process, and then set up on the basis of the chemistry and toxicology what type of medical surveillance
mm-hmm.
program we might design.
Mm-hmm.
So we can detect the earliest changes before anybody was hurt.
Mm-hmm.
And in addition, we'd set up a program working with the industrial hygienists. These are really technical people who know how to measure the chemical concentrations in the ambient air.
Mm-hmm.
And between the two of them, we set up surveillance programs. So we had continuous air monitoring, measuring the concentrations in the air. And we coupled this with our medical surveillance, observations, examinations, tests.
Was DuPont serious about...
You better believe they were serious, because they had some really very nasty chemicals there. Mm-hmm. I mean, polyurethane, for example, everybody takes it for granted, but polyurethane starts out with huge amounts of CO and carbon monoxide in natural gas, which is then coupled with chlorine, you get something COCl2, and that's phosgene.
Mm-hmm.
And that's in humongous quantities again.
Yeah. Long as you're on the subject, I'd like to take this subject out of time, but go on.
Okay, yeah, sure.
On the issue of the seriousness with which the companies that you have been associated with or know about, how they took it. Were they ashamed? Did they put tongue in cheek?
No.
Did they work very hard?
Some of the major corporations, matter of fact, number two largest producer in the United States, chemicals, is a sham.
With who? What?
Well, that was Allied Chemical. Allied ran a sloppy operation.
Mm-hmm.
A major producer.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Allied was also the people who brought us that mess in Virginia where they contaminated the whole of the lower Chesapeake Bay. But on the other hand, other corporations were very serious about it. And in the field, you soon found out who the people for real and who were the people that were, how do you want to characterize them? I would characterize them as negligent, incompetent, don't give a damn situations. You soon found out which corporations were that and which corporations were for real. DuPont was for real. Now, this is not to say that there were not some hassles I got into with foreign investigators subsequent years about some of the things that DuPont was sitting on top of. They did sit on top of one or two things, which were really serious things. But by and large, in day-to-day operations, they meant it. And of course, you know, it's sort of a remnant of their culture. Remember, they started out in this world as powder manufacturers. And in 1832, the company almost was wiped out by an explosion. E.I. DuPont, the old Elie Thorez himself, the founder of the company, after that required that the manager and his family live on the premises where they were manufacturing powder.
So they would get blown up?
They and their family would get blown up.
Mm-hmm.
They were for serious because of that reality. The company almost got wiped out again in the 1870s with similar type of explosion. So, yeah, they were serious. Others were not. Union Carbide was serious then, despite Bhopal. That's a whole different story. Dow was serious. The only trouble was that Dow was in the middle of Michigan, where the old American values were always there, and no one ever questioned it when they got into the napalm business. Unfortunately, this was the country asking them to step forward, do they do it? They did it without too much thought of what they were getting into. And the Agent Orange story is not a story altogether, but these are aberrations for that company. That company has continued to be very responsible.
Talking about Dow.
Dow.
Yeah.
Huh? Continue to be very responsible.
Yeah, good.
But others, Allied, I put in that category, still haven't learned. And subsequent experiences with doing consulting over the years, I have found that their plants, their managers, are don't give a damn.
I'd like to ask a couple of the local companies. I'm thinking of Alcoa and Westinghouse.
Well, they're two different breed of cats. First of all, one of the things I found as I got into the field is you picked and choose which companies you want to be associated with. I would never have dealt with Allied. I might have worked for DuPont. There were not many Jews working for DuPont, and of course, it turns out the chairman of the board a few years later was Jewish, but that was a
Shapiro.
Right, Irving Shapiro, yeah. That was a very strange turn of events, I must say, because this was a non-Jewish, white shoe, WASP company.
How did it affect you?
Didn't affect me at all, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Made no difference.
Mm-hmm.
That was curious, very curious, I must say. Mm-hmm. I never caught any kind of nastiness at all.
Mm-hmm.
I was very, obviously, I was very alert for this sort of thing, because it has a reputation. You know? But never caught it.
Mm-hmm.
Never heard it.
Mm-hmm.
Alcoa was, let's guess ahead of things, of course, but...
I deliberately wanted to stay on this subject.
Okay,
Because we happened to pick it up and I wouldn't have thought of it again.
Okay, well, let me talk about Alcoa. That was very interesting. When I was interviewing for the job here, it came after me, and the vice president at that time for health and safety was another physician, and he campaigned me pretty hard. And I came down here and I had a series of meetings. Finally, I had a last meeting with Chrome George, who at that
Where
time...
Where were you at the time?
I was at the University of Michigan. So
mm-hmm.
I had a meeting with Chrome George, who was the president of the company. It's K-R-O-M-E, George. It's, I thought it was a funny name, but man, you know, a woman company. Why Chrome, anyway?
Mm-hmm.
And John Harper, who was the chairman of Alcoa at that time. And they were telling me their concern and their sense of responsibility for the health of people who work there and the environment. And I said, well, Mr. Harper, I said, this is very interesting, but what is the real reason for this sense of responsibility for the environment? He said, well, I'll tell you. He said, when I was in Tennessee at the major plant there, not near Knoxville, said, we discovered that we were poisoning these cows. And after we decided, after investigating this and getting consultants in, that indeed the fluoride was contaminating the feed, the grasses, and producing a condition called osteofluorosis, that we ought to pay off the farmers because we caused them damage to the cows. And he said, we started a campaign of having these cows examined, or at least claims were made, and he said, we suddenly discovered we were paying for every damn sick cow within 500 miles. And he said, we better find out what's involved in this condition. So he said, before we're going to pay any more farmers for sick cows that have nothing to do with the problem, we're going to do some research on this. And indeed, they did support a lot of very important research that went on at several centers around the country. And he said, well, we decided we're doing this to cows. So what we're doing to people? So they got themselves their first medical director then in the 1950s, who was a professor at McGill. And he published a fair amount of work in the open literature, of course. This is the only way you can really maintain your credibility.
Mm-hmm.
And he knew what he was doing. He got to be very expert in this area of fluoride.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, at this was the same time in the 1950s when the Public Health Service was also interested in fluoride for fluoridation purposes.
Mm-hmm.
So Alcoa worked fairly quite closely and supported and worked with the Public Health Service because fluoride was their concern. And of course, fluoride is a prevention for caries, dental caries was a concern of the Public Health Service in setting up the standards. So they worked very closely with the government at that time. And so it did. They were responsible as far as I could determine.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what helps make this decision as to who you want to work with, who you don't. Westinghouse, on the other hand, had a very interesting history. They had a medical director during the war, and until about 1948, and he was too far ahead of his time. He was way ahead of his time.
What's his name?
T. Lyle Hazlett, H-A-Z-L-E-T-T, I think something like that. And he was unfortunately ahead of his time. About the time he was ready to retire, they said, oh boy, we don't want another medical director here for a long time. So they never did have one. Until about 12 years ago. They had a layman who was responsible for administering the whole medical operation, and as a result, it was a real second-rate one, and I knew it was a second-rate one because when I was living in Columbus, there was a big Westinghouse plant there, and I know that the guy who was running it was doing it part-time. He was a surgeon, and he didn't know anything. And I knew he was taking them in terms of what it cost them to run that, because his pricing was ridiculous, which I had reason to find out about. So Westinghouse, because of this experience with Hazlett, Dr. Hazlett, didn't have much of a program after. They didn't want one.
Mm-hmm.
But I never thought that Westinghouse was a pretty well-managed corporation either.
Mm-hmm.
And I think subsequent events have shown this to be the case.
I must admit to concur in that.
Well, I think the whole financial community concurs in that, given what their track record has been like. Now, that doesn't mean a good corporation which is profitable doesn't have also has a good medical program. It doesn't necessarily follow, but it depends upon the corporate culture to a large extent. I mean, the DuPont culture is quite clear. Their safety record, because of their history, is unbelievable. The story is told in the business that this plant manager, every time anybody was hurt, the plant manager was down the medical department really fast because his bonus was on the line and his job be on the line. And the story runs that the plant manager once was walking through the plant and saw a painter up in a bosun chair painting a stack, and as he watched, the man fell out of the chair and he yelled out, "You're fired," before he hit the ground.
Mm-hmm.
He's not a lost time injury that way. That's sort of an apocryphal story.
Yeah.
But this sort of embeds itself in a corporate culture, which makes for corporations you want to work for and corporations you wouldn't touch with a 10-foot pole.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I guess we sort of digressed.
Yeah, no. Dr. Dinman, would you state where in industrial medicine your life participation has been concerning agencies and topics?
Well, I've had a very fortunate career. I've spent one half of my professional career as an academic, both at the Ohio State University and University of Michigan, and now University of Pittsburgh. And I spent the other half of my professional career practicing, especially in a corporate setting, at a, obviously, a fairly responsible level. And in the course of these two components of my career, I've dealt with federal agencies and international agencies. In terms of the academic, as an academic, you find that you start developing a reputation in the field, that you end up working for the National Research Council, the NRC, of the National Academy of Science. And this is a very nice way the government has of getting advice on various scientific subjects for practically free. The National Research Council, which is charged with under the charter of the National Academy of Science, which was signed into existence by Abraham Lincoln, was charged with providing scientific advice to the government. And they would then appoint various committees to address certain subjects. And they would draw from academic resources, and they didn't pay them anything except expenses, which is then the National Academy, the National Research Council, of course, contracted with the agencies, and that was what supported their staff and infrastructure and the costs of all these very high-level experts, but low-cost experts. So the universities have always, over the years, over more than a century now, have provided this consultation advice to the government through the National Research Council, or the NRC. The election to the National Academy of Science is quite an honorific sort of thing, but that's the old boy network who runs that. And everybody that works for the NRC sort of hopes that maybe someday their great works will be recognized. Well, it doesn't work out that way at all. But nevertheless, that's an easy way for the government to be provided information. Now, the government has variously utilized it. For example, around the beginning of World War I, as occurred in Europe in 1913, Newton D. Baker, who was the Secretary of War at that time in the Wilson cabinet, was approached by several people in the academic community, they were scientists, and they thought that maybe the government should make more use of it because it sort of had fallen by the wayside. And Newton D. Baker said, well, he'd look into it. And 3 weeks later, he met with these people again. He said, well, I don't think we need any help. I've searched throughout the War Department. I found we have two chemists there. So that sort of stood in abeyance for a while, but later on they came to their senses. And ever since then, the Academy and the National Research Council have been used by the government to provide aid and consultation.
Well, the high point was the Second World War.
Oh, very much so, very much so. And it's continued ever since.
Mm-hmm.
It's continued ever since.
And what was your contact with?
Well, I started to make a name while I was an academic in toxicology.
Mm-hmm.
And in occupational health and occupational hygiene. So at one point there, I was appointed to a very interesting body called the Armed Forces Epidemiology Board, which had various commissions. And I was commissioned in this Commission on Environmental Hygiene. And we were given active ranks of colonel. I remember I was a PFC in the military, I don't get any farther than that.
Mm-hmm.
And we would be sent to make investigations for the military, Army, Navy, Air Force, on problems that may have come up, and on a continuous advisory basis.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, in Vietnam, when they were having a lot of heat casualties, which they learned all about in World War II, which they learned all about in World War I, but they had forgotten all about it each time. They called them a commission to do some investigations of the heat casualty loads they had in Vietnam. And we gave them advice as to how to prevent it, because we only reinvented the wheel and reinvented by one in World War I or World War II. But each time they go on another campaign, they sort of forget the history of the past. So we would advise them there. And then as our reputation toxicology grew, I was appointed to the National Research Council Advisory Committee on Toxicology. Then what we would do is set standards for military operations or government operations, which were not standards for general population. We had to take that into account. Or we would also help organize research, and then we would monitor that research so that, for example, the question came up of how much carbon dioxide would be allowable in a space capsule for any length of time over time. And there wasn't any information, so they commissioned research, and we monitored the research and evaluated it, and helped to set standards for space capsules, space vehicles, for atmospheric contaminants in the space vehicles, such as carbon dioxide, for one thing, among a number of other things. So we also set emergency standards in case there was a missile failure. Missiles did have, at that time, certain nitrogen oxide fuels, oxidizers, and we would set standards for people going in to do repairs or doing emergency work or evacuation. And this is the sort of thing we did for the National Research Council and mm-hmm. the Commission on Toxicology. I ended up as chairman of that committee mm-hmm. in 1974-76. So that was one series of contacts, mainly the National Research Council when I was an academic.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as I became a corporate type, obviously they were a little suspicious of that. So
mm-hmm.
I suddenly changed in their mind or something.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, the academics were always suspicious of the corporate types. And that sort of faded away as far as NRC was concerned, about 76.
Mm-hmm.
That phase was essentially associated with the academic part of my career. The other dealing with the government was in the regulatory area, and that was while I was working in the corporate part of my experience. And that meant we had to review prospective standards for workplace environments. Mm-hmm. And in areas in which we had expertise, particularly fluoride, for example, mm-hmm. we would also act on advisory committees to the government, but always with a bit of a backing off by the government type, because they were afraid they might be corrupted by us corporate types. Except the real professionals in the government really didn't have that problem. We had a good professional relationship with them, but the people were sort of quasi-professionals, or because of the way committees were made up anymore of interested parties, which meant activists at the time, too. They were self-proclaimed experts, and of course they knew little, and they were suspicious of people from the corporate sector, because obviously they were tainted.
Mm-hmm.
And that got to be a bit of a problem, too, but it was something to live with.
Mm-hmm.
That would also mean that when there were standards which were very much applicable to us, we would participate in